makes sense.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is February 8th. The first item on the agenda is informational meeting on the Oregon Youth Authority. Mr. O'Leary.
Yeah, you know, Mr. Chair, I just want to point out, we get all these guys coming back in front of us that used to work with us years ago. I mean, look how well he's done.
We haven't been here too long.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Vice Chairs Olson and Williamson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Fairbor Spaksoresh, Director of Oregon Youth Authority. And Joe, of course, everyone knows him, Joe O'Leary, our Deputy Director. We are going to do a quick walkthrough of the system, juvenile justice system, talk about Oregon Youth Authority, our partners, some of the initiatives that we have, and then finish with our legislative issues and bills. And hopefully we'll stick to our time. And Joe and I will go back and forth in this presentation, so I'll turn it over to him to start with the system overview.
Members of the committee, Chair Barker, it is a privilege to be back in front of the House Judiciary Committee this afternoon. For the record, my name is Joe O'Leary. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Youth Authority, and I am going to walk you through a few slides that some of you will find very familiar, but we'll walk you through what the Oregon juvenile justice system looks like at a high level, a little bit about the population of youth that OYA serves, and a little bit more about our agency. And then I'll hand it off to Fairbors, who's going to tell you more about some of the really cutting-edge strategic initiatives that our agency is engaged in. This is a chart we call the sideways triangle for obvious reasons, and it shows the functional flow of youth that come to the attention of juvenile justice in Oregon. There are a lot of young people in Oregon, about 400,000 young people between the ages of 12 and 18, give or take. Not that many get involved with juvenile courts in Oregon. What this shows you is that in a given year, this cut is 2015, only about 8,000 youth were engaged in delinquent behavior that rose to the level of a referral to the juvenile court. And in that same year, only about 27 youth were actually adjudicated of delinquent conduct. The lion's share of those young people, about 2,200 of those young people, are supervised at the local level. They're not removed from the home. They are placed in the jurisdiction of the court, and they are provided with services and supervision by our great partners in 36 counties across the state, the local juvenile departments around the state, for whom, actually, I should add, the Oregon Youth Authority is a pass-through for state general fund dollars that actually go to those county juvenile departments to help them divert kids that might otherwise end up in OYA's care. Only about 500 kids end up in the Youth Authority's custody. And there are two ways that a court can commit a young person to the Youth Authority. One way is for the court to remove the youth from the home and place him in our care for purposes of probation, which gives us the opportunity to place the youth in a residential treatment program. And I'll show you where those are across the state. The other mechanism by which a youth can come into our care is to be committed by the court for placement in a youth correctional facility. And we have 11 youth correctional facilities around the state. We'll show you where those are. Unlike youth who are committed through the Department of Corrections, youth that are committed from the juvenile courts are in our care, and we have parole authority over them. In other words, the Youth Authority decides when they are stable and safe enough to be released from a youth correctional facility and moved to a step-down facility. There is another way that young people get into our close custody, not through the juvenile courts, but by virtue of the seriousness of the underlying offense. If they are charged and convicted with a Measure 11 offense or a Measure 11 related offense, even at ages 15, 16, or 17, they are legally treated as an adult and placed in the physical custody of the Oregon Youth Authority, either until their sentence is over or until they turn 25. I'm going backwards in the slides, pardon me. This is our mission, vision, values, and you know, there are really two themes that permeate our mission and our organic statutes. Those two themes are accountability and reformation. We take those very seriously. We also take seriously the vision that is not just about reducing recidivism, though we want our young people to be crime-free. Our vision for them is broader than that. We also want them to be productive. 99% of them will return to the communities from which they came. We want them to be educated. We want them to have the skills they need to be productive members of their communities. A little bit of historical perspective. The Youth Authority was created in 1995 by Senate Bill 1. Prior to that, juvenile justice at the state level was handled through the Children's Services Division of the Department of Human Services. It was a task force headed by then Attorney General Ted Kulongoski created the Youth Authority. And in part, it was also at the time that the voters were considering Measure 11, and the lawmakers that sat in the seats that you're in right now saw that the policy choice of the citizens of Oregon was likely going to be one in which very youthful individuals were going to be legally treated like adults. And the thought was, at the time, you know, let's not put those young people in an adult facility. Let's have them in a juvenile correctional facility where they have opportunities for education and treatment and reformation. The minimum age of jurisdiction that a court can place a youth in OYA is 12, and as I mentioned, 25 is the age out. That is the top end of the range. For those youth that are placed in our care through the adult courts, the offense must have occurred before the youth turned 18. But as long as it happens before 18, then the statute requires that youth to be placed in our physical care. And if their sentence is over before they turn 25, then they return to the community and are supervised by adult community corrections.
Sure.
Yes.
The rough opinion, Joe, how many of those go eventually into DOC?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, the number of youth, it varies. I know we have run those numbers, and you know, in a year it can be as few as a dozen, maybe as many as 20. For the members of the committee, the question is about youth who are committed through the adult courts and whose sentence continues past their 25th birthday. My boss is going to correct me on the number. 32 is that last year? In 2016, we had 32.
Small number, though. It's a relatively small number.
Relatively small, but that's out of 300 DOC commits that are in our care.
Follow-up. Yes. Joe, how often are those folks going into DOC because they age into it versus other ways that you can go from OYA to DOC?
Thank you, Chair Barker and Representative Williamson. There is a statute that permits the director of the Youth Authority to move a youth from the youth, a DOC youth, from the Youth Authority close custody to adult corrections. Actually, the statute allows that to happen at age 16 or older. And historically, the agency had used that tool as a behavior compliance mechanism. And many years ago, there were as many as about 40 a year. We've been applying some of our predictive analytics tools that actually applied to these kids. We can actually say, you know, how likely is this kid going to be to reoffend if we send them to adult corrections? And as we've used those tools increasingly, the answer has been a whole lot more likely, which gives us a public safety reason to keep the kid at the Youth Authority. So we've gone from about 40 a year, maybe 5 years ago, to last year, I think we had five. We only transfer those youth in the most extreme cases. cases, and or where the data shows that they're not going to, the community safety is not going to be harmed by transferring them.
And Joe, can they can opt in themselves, right, if they're over 18?
That's a great question too, Chair Barker, Representative Williamson. I think legally, no, they cannot.
Okay.
They can certainly ask, but it's the youth authority that has the discretion. I say that because we've actually had a few cases where, you know, I mean, you have a DOC kid who's 18 or 19. You got to go to school when you're with us. You got to do treatment. You got to work. Sometimes there are kids who don't want to do that. And I'm thinking of one kid as an example who had, you know, generational issues. He had relatives in the adult system, and he wanted to go to the adult system. And he was actually, this guy was willing to get into fights to try to get moved.
I remember that youth.
Yeah.
That's
what's prompting
the question.
We said no. but we said no because we ran his numbers, and he would have been 150 times more likely to reoffend, according to some of our data. So we said no. We also brought in his grandmother, and we brought in a lot of family supports around him, and, you know, gave him other opportunities. That young man ended up being the battalion chief at our firefighting crew in Le Grand, and was a success story.
Great, thank
Thanks
you.
For that
one
question.
Other question about that. So the number of people who age out, turn 25,
yes,
and you move on, I'm assuming something, that most of those people are doing long-term for example, for murder, for the most part. I know some of them are on the end of a sentence and will be out within a year or so, but are not most of them going to be there?
Good question, Chair Barker. I don't know the numbers exactly off the top of my head, but I think it's a mix. I wouldn't necessarily say that most are long-term. We definitely do have a handful of youth. They're not many that have like the 25-year type sentences and would be, you know, going to DOC long-term. A lot, though, I want to say, are months. Many are a period of a few years.
Okay, thank you.
So I guess just, thanks, Mr. Chair, just to follow up on that, it's probably safe to say then just about everybody that's going past the age of 25 into DOC is a Measure 11 crime.
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, they're either Measure 11 or they started as Measure 11 and they pled out to an attempted Measure 11 or were convicted of a lesser included. We call those a waived. But they all started out in adult court. They're getting determinate sentences.
Well, I'm sorry. Yeah. What I should have said is the kind of the top tier of Measure 11.
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, I don't know that. There are some. There are definitely some second degrees that end up. You know, if the kid might just come in at 18.
Right.
There are a few. I think I can get. I can try to break that out. At least look at those 32 or so and give you a breakout to give you a sense.
Actually, when you look at the and Joe has this slide later in the deck. The type of crime, there are actually very few kids, very small percentage that are at the top tier. So quite often, and this is part of the problem as well, we have a kid that, and I call them kids, but they may only have a month left or a year left or 6 months left. And you know, those kids are also included in this 32 number. So we actually, when we look at the median length of stay for DOC youth, that complete their sentence at DOC is 5.5 years.
What is it?
5.5 years. So when you actually look at the entire continuum, there are few youth that have sentences of 20 years or 25 years, but the majority of them are in the mid-tier or the low-tier.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I can just follow, it would be very helpful if we could have a profile. I have a bill you may have heard.
Yes.
Provide a second look for people at that point.
Yes,
possible resentencing hearing. It would be very useful to find out whether these are people who there's no point in trying to get a second look because they're not going to get.
Right.
As opposed to the number that might be helped by that process. I think basically the notion of putting a juvenile into the adult population is not necessarily a very good idea.
They're 25.
Hmm?
They're 25. They're not.
Yeah.
They're no longer.
No, I know.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
About the time the brain almost develops, yeah, so where they understand what's
Thank
going
you.
On.
I want to go back to one thing that that you said. I think it was you, Joe. So you have 11 facilities around the state. Do you do any overflow or any sort of things where you would have local counties hold on to OIA kids, or do they all go to OIA facilities?
Chair Barker, Representative Gorsuch, if I understand your question correctly, the youth that are committed to our care through the juvenile courts, they are either the court either says you will be placed in youth correctional facility, and they are at least initially, and then we have parole authority as to when they get out. Or the court says you're going to be placed in OIA for probation. And then we are removing that youth from the home. Well, I shouldn't say they are removed from the home. We don't are removing. But they are placed in either independent living if they're old enough or a residential program. I jumped to the slide where it shows our close custody facilities, the red stars, not the blue stars. Don't get scared. only 11 and soon to be only 9 close custody facilities. And these are where our community residential programs are. These are, you asked about county programs. We actually do contract with 3 county programs that actually run their residential. One's in Klamath County, is a great program for young women. One is in Wasco County, if memory serves, one is in Douglas County. But the rest of those community res providers are private nonprofits. For example, St. Mary's in Beaverton, Janus Youth Program in Portland. But these folks do a great job. So these aren't state employees. These are contracts that we hold. Related to the budget, these folks also hold contracts with the Human Services for dependency kids. They are slated to get really decent increase in their reimbursement rates, which have long been a source of consternation. There have not been enough to cover their costs.
Follow-up. So if you're dealing with somebody as in my case, Multnomah County,
yes,
the juvenile facility there is only for local county more temporary stuff, right?
Yeah. Chair Barker, Representative Gorsuch, I understand your question now. That is like the functional equivalent of pretrial detention. Yeah. So the Donald E. Long facility in Multnomah County is a county-run, county-owned facility. OIA has a co-located parole and probation office in the building. This is one of the cool things about the juvenile justice system that we do believe it's like one kid, one plan. The youth may be placed in different locations, but pre-adjudication, if a youth is determined to be held for serious offenses, Measure 11 offenses, that's where they stay. Then once they are convicted, those Measure 11 kids, then they end up coming to one of our facilities.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please.
So since I've jumped ahead to where our facilities are, and we have a variety of different facilities, only one serves young women. That is our facility in Albany, the Oak Creek Youth Correctional Facility. It's co-located with Young Women's Transition Program, which we are very happy that the governor has proposed permanent funding for in her budget. Really, the backbone of our system is Oak Creek in Albany, the Rogue Valley Youth Correctional Facility in Representative Stark's backyard in Grants Pass, and the McLaren Youth Correctional Facility in Woodburn. We will be closing the Hillcrest Youth Correctional Facility in Salem. That's been an 18-month or longer plan that will close in July. The governor's budget has also recommended the closure of the North Coast Youth Correctional Facility out in Warrenton. Mentioned our community residential programs. I also want to mention our foster and proctor homes. I think folks associate foster care with DHS and dependency kids, but our foster parents are a huge resource to us. Approximately 140 young people in foster and proctor homes across the state. A little bit shifting a little bit to the demographics. This slide shows you the age, gender population for youth about 10 to 18 in Oregon on the left, and on the right is the gender population for Oregon Youth Authority. So this is the girls are smarter than boys slide. We have a lot more young men. Though I will say the young women that are committed to our care tend to have much more acute presenting issues. Everybody has trauma history, and I'll show you a slide that breaks that down by gender here in a moment. But the young women have been dealt an especially tough hand.
So are you seeing any increase in the girls' population?
Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, yeah. While the boys' population has kind of plateaued, we think, the girls' population is increasing and inching up.
And do you know why?
Well, that is the magic question. I will show you some of the issues that I think are similar to the adult women's population: substance abuse, sexual abuse, victimization,
mental health.
Yeah, and it's property related kind of offenses for the most part that get kids young women committed to us. This is the most troubling slide about the demographics of our population. And again, this is a comparison, Oregon as a state, and the one to the left is Oregon Youth Authority. And you will see that there is an overrepresentation of African-American youth compared to the general population, and an overrepresentation of Native American youth compared to the population. And more troubling, if I were to granularize this just for close custody youth, it gets worse. And if we were to granularize this just for DOC youth, it gets even worse. This was the slide I was referring to in response to Representative Williamson's question. We poll our youth every 2 years to get an updated, refreshed picture of their biosocial backgrounds. And as you can see, drug and alcohol use, mental health, and with the young women, particularly sexual abuse, are very prevalent. And this is not to say, oh, poor them, but rather, if we don't know what happened to them, we as an agency and our direct care staff are not going to do as good of a job helping them develop into adults. And we've already talked about the crime profile. So with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Fairbors, who is going to walk you through our key strategic initiatives.
Thanks, Joe. And Chair Barker, I know we are running a bit long, so I try to be quick. Just want to briefly talk about three strategic initiatives that we have: the Youth Reformation System, the Positive Human Development, and our 10-year plan. The Youth Reformation System is a system that uses data analytics and research to answer some primary questions, and those questions are: what should the capacity of the system be? Are the right youth coming to us? Are they being placed in the right environment with the right type of services? Are we hiring the right type of staff to deal with them and get them to where they need to be? If you're spending money on a program, do we actually know that that money is paying results and those programs are being effective? And finally, community context has two pieces, two questions. What factors are bringing youth to us? And when we transition kids back to the community, are the right services in place so that we do not create a revolving door, so that the kids don't return to us? The system was presented back in 2013 legislative session. Representative Williamson remembers that because she and Senator Winters drafted a budget note that basically instructed us to do four things. They told us develop a business plan that, number one, includes efficiencies, maximizing asset utility that effectively use taxpayer dollars. Number two, create a timeline and project plan to implement the youth reformation system. They said, we're not going to give you any money, but do what, with what you have and as the capacity increases and the numbers decrease, use your internal funds. They told us, don't compromise the safety and security of youth, staff, or the community, and do it to the best of your ability without any layoffs. So what we've done is
it's been a comprehensive budget note that asked you guys to do a lot without any more money. So good job.
Thank you. And we'll have an opportunity in our Ways and Means presentation to talk in much more detail about what we were asked to do and what we have done. But the next slide actually is highlighting a series of tools that have been developed around this continuum of youth reformation system. And you can see that these tools don't just apply to OYA. They're actually across the entire continuum. We now, with the data and analytics that we have, can begin to identify the trajectory of a youth heading into our system as early as birth. Mm-hmm. We can identify what systems are bringing the most number of youth to us. You're not going to be surprised. It's mental health, it's alcohol and drug, and it's foster care. We are also able to tell you what is the most prominent factor that leads fifth graders into our system, and that is moving from school to school during the school year. Who moves from school to school during the school year? Foster kids, parents that don't have resources, et cetera. Now, the second tool here that's highlighted escalation to OYA can actually be applied. Again, the youth is not with OYA yet, but the county juvenile department now has gotten a referral, and they can apply this tool to say, what's the probability of this kid ending up in OYA? And applying services so that to divert that kid from coming into our system. And this is actually a good point to highlight the partnership that we have with our counties. This is a continuum. There's no way that we can do this work without our county partners, without our providers. And they are helping us pilot these tools. Wasco County is currently piloting the escalation to OYA tool. And then the predicted success rate is a tool that when the kid's at our doorstep and we're sitting down with the county juvenile departments, with our staff and their staff, and trying to figure out what's the best place for this youth to be, we can take a recommendation to the court that is based on data and analytics. So, and again, I won't go through the rest of this stuff, but just very briefly, that feeder system actually has a end piece to it, and we haven't yet started that project yet, but that is the project that would help us create the right transition, again, working with our county juvenile departments to make sure that when the kids go back to the community, they can be successful. Joe mentioned the number of dollars that goes to the counties. It's pretty important that we focus on this partnership with the counties, and as we move forward, make sure that resources are adequate for them to do the work that they're asked to do. Because it's really the juvenile version of justice reinvestment. It's helping the local counties divert kids from coming into OYA, and if they don't have the resources, they can't do that. The next slide talks about when we began following the budget note, implementing the youth reformation system, we quickly realized that to implement this system, this required the change in mindset and practice. And as a result of that, we took a national concept, positive youth development, which basically tells us that youth are different than adults. And if we look at youth from a lens of, from a resource lens versus a victim lens or a villain lens, we have a much better opportunity to turn successful youth back into the community. So we redesigned this model, and we included the staff in this thing, and we call it positive human development because we believe that we are all developing in one way or the other. At the core of the system is safety and security. We cannot compromise on safety for youth and for staff. The next level is caring and supportive relationships. Everyone needs that. The system does not compromise on accountability and high expectations. The next is meaningful participation. The kid needs to own their own case plan. And finally, community connection at the facility level, at the living unit level, and at the community level when they come back to the community. And I think the next slide shows the other part of the budget note that instructed us to do a facility analysis. And as part of that, we realized that we cannot complete this shift in culture and the implementation of the youth reformation system if we did not address the physical environment in which youth live. As part of that, we're consolidating Hillcrest and McLaren, And you can see this is an example of an intake unit, a current intake unit on the left at Hillcrest, and the future living unit, which will be completed at McLaren by July of this year. The next slide, and Representative Stark may remember this at the groundbreaking event at Rogue Valley Youth Correctional Facility. This is a current classroom at Rogue Valley Youth Correctional Facility that has 100 youth in a very confined environment. And currently, education is taking place on living units, and you all know that education contributes significantly to healthy reformation and development of youth. And we are constructing a new school to create a more normalized environment for kids and help them succeed in their education, which will significantly impact recidivism in the positive way.
The school will be a big deal for the young people and the staff at Rogue Valley. This is a big population institution. It's 100 kids, but the footprint of that institution is one of our regional facilities. It's very, very tight, and kids live in a room about half this size and currently go to school. The picture on the left is the room, like, literally next door from their living room. We're able to, with the funding from the 10-year plan, what we're able to do is open the perimeter fence, expand it, and have an environment where kids can actually leave the compound of the youth correctional facility. And there'll still be a gate around it for sure, but at least walk through a field and go to a modest but modern high school with a vocational education program and other opportunities they just don't currently have. This is just kind of the list of the things that we're following. Our one and only agency bill is an isolation alternatives bill. We're looking to reduce and prevent the use of isolation in our youth correctional facilities. Senate Bill 82 was heard in Senate Judiciary this morning and will be worked, I believe, on the 14th, hopefully come over your way soon. And this basically codifies our internal policy that we do not use isolation as a punishment for rule violations that occur within the youth correctional facilities. We're watching and standing ready to assist with Representative Greenlick and others who are interested in pursuing data around sentencing changes, and also cooperating with Representative Olson and Rayfield and others who are interested in exploring potential changes in the supervision of DOC youth and others. And then, you know, basically any bills that have to do with education or foster care or residential treatment, a lot of those bills are crafted in a way that apply to the dependency population or apply to the community population of kids in general. But most of them have an impact on the juvenile justice population, either at the state level or the local level. So we're watching all of those and participating as we can to make sure that there are no negative unintended consequences for our kids in the juvenile justice world. And then finally, we're obviously very interested in the budget situation. As I mentioned, the governor's proposal of a closure of one of our facilities, but permanent funding for a young woman's transition program, closely following and standing ready to support our local partners in juvenile departments across Oregon who rely on state funding to help make Oregon a really robust state for juvenile justice, as well as our residential partners in the nonprofit world and a few counties who give us who have contract relationships with us, and we want to make sure that they're paid adequately to do the good work they're doing. That is our presentation. If you have any questions, we're happy to.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have two questions. One, and I didn't hear it. What's the cost for a bed today with the Oregon Youth Authority? I remember one time it was up like around $300.
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, if memory serves, it is right around $300. That is, though, a very rough calculation. If you take the kids in custody and divide our general fund budget by those number of kids, and there are lots of reasons that I would tell you that's not a good way to estimate it. But that said, we are more expensive than adult corrections. We have a more robust youth to staff ratio, though I'll tell you, we're way outside the national best practice. We have 25 kids in a unit, and the best practice is to have 12. And those new units, the six new units at McLaren, are only going to have 16. But we're keeping the same staffing levels. So, you know, that's kind of our glide path to try to get to right size our youth to staff ratio.
Yeah. I thought one more. So I know that, I mean, from my perspective anyways, that Oregon Youth Authority and the county juvenile directors have, I think, a pretty dang good relationship for working together. I know that.
A good relationship.
Yes. I know that about 81% of the adjudicated youth are actually covered, you know, within the counties. Mm-hmm. I think you had that. Yep. If you dig a little deeper into that, for the informal types of, you know, incidents with youth, it's probably higher than that for that percentage. I guess my concern is, what happens if, and maybe you can play this out with us, if you get hit with this 15% cut?
Chair Barker,
sure.
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, I think there's reason to be concerned. This is, you know, public safety as a whole is a system, and juvenile justice is absolutely a system, and there are hydraulic effects. You know, Fairbores was alluding to some of the tools that we're piloting in counties to help identify the kids that are on a trajectory to come to us and change that trajectory. You know, in part, they can do that because the state is supporting their operations through pass-through grants. And, you know, to the extent we pull away from that, counties will have to make decisions about whether or not they continue to do that. And one hydraulic effect might be sending more kids to the state to manage. And that, you know, could have a very negative effect on what we're trying to do to change the dynamic, use data to make better decisions, and it could also have a very negative effect on public safety.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Vile.
Yeah, Joe, I'm looking at this same sideways triangle, and frankly, being a bit newer to this than Representative Olson, I'm astounded by it. Between the 13,000 referred and the 8,000 referred for criminal offenses, what's that 5,000 number difference all about?
Chair Barker and Representative Vile, I want to answer that with a caveat that that would be a better question for our juvenile department partners, because these are the youth that get referred to them at the local level. My impression and anecdotal understanding from having previously practiced in juvenile court and understanding a little bit about that system is that a lot of kids that get referred to a juvenile court end up with an informal disposition and never end up getting a formal petition, that is a formal criminal charge filed against them. There are things in the delinquency statute that give the juvenile departments and the court the opportunity to engage in something called formal accountability agreements, which is basically a contract with the youth and the family by which if they do certain things like pay restitution, stay in school, I'm making these up as examples, and stay out of trouble after a certain period of time, the agreement is no petition is filed. You don't get in, you know, formal trouble. A lot of those cases, I think, fall away from that. I'm sure a lot of those cases are investigated and it's determined, you know, yeah, this was a referral, but it was a referral maybe for a runaway or some kind of what we call status offenses in the juvenile justice business, some kind of nuisance maybe behavior, but doesn't rise to the level of a criminal conduct complaint.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So I can understand how we would want to avoid tagging a kid with something that maybe we can put a lesser tag on them. in your view, and both of you with your experience, are we not giving a significant number of kids an opportunity to get some help and a bit of a new path that we should, because we're trying to avoid putting a label on them?
Want me to take that too?
Well, I can represent.
That's a good one.
Well, I can try to answer that question. It would not be on any based on any hard scientific data, but what I can tell you that what we're trying to do is use the data and individualize the decision making. So we are very close to being at a place that we can say what works for individual youth versus applying a blanket model to across a population. In some cases, I believe that you're correct, that some kids can benefit by higher level of supervision. In many cases, youth come to us because the right level of service does not exist in the community. Especially in the case of the female population, a lot of these girls are trafficked, a lot of them have trauma issues, and because services don't exist in the county or in the local environment, in fact, judges at times, and this is the truth, apologize for sending youth away because there's no other services available for them. We know, and they know, that a locked-up environment is not the best for those kids, but there's no other option. At the same time, there are youth in the community that could be benefit by higher level of supervision. So for me, the key to getting to the core of your question, which is an excellent question, is how do you individualize what we know about science and data so that we can specifically address each need for each youth and serve them at the right level with the right intervention.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Post, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Guys, I'm really excited that you were here today. Looking ahead at this. Faribault, we have a mutual friend who is watching us on the internet right now, Randy Butler.
Oh, absolutely.
And he has been texting me with questions, but we won't ask all those questions. But one of the things that I wanted to ask was, what have you seen maybe in the last year and a half since he and the volunteers that have been coming with him, what difference are you seeing at Hillcrest in the behavior and in anything that you would bring to light? Because then I think that I would... If you don't, I would explain to our committee what's going on.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Barker and Representative Post. First of all, let me, and I know we're running over time, but I want to answer your question. And this is a sensitive topic because we are talking about religion.
Yep.
And generally, we're not very comfortable in the public sector to talk about religion. But frankly, what Randy brings to us is not just religion. What he brings to us is some core values. He has become a second father to many of our kids. For the first time, and this was an incredible sight, this last Christmas, he brought his entire... Maybe you were there, I don't know. Were you there?
No.
You weren't there. Okay, so there were a whole lot of people from the congregation there. He brought his entire choir and music. And, you know, our kids were actually singing Christmas songs. And I stood there and I said, when was the last time that these kids, it took them a while to get into it, and they were then really into it. And I said, when was the last time that these kids actually had an opportunity to stand with family members or at a church or, you know, any place else and actually sing Christmas songs? I don't know, probably many years. But again, what Randy has brought to these kids is a sense of value, what they need to do in order to be successful. He sits down with any of them if they need to, and he will counsel them. He asks for accountability. Participation in his groups is completely voluntary. You don't have to be a Christian to attend that. And everything that he does is, you know, the Muslim youth, the youth who claim that they are agnostic or Buddhist, they all attend Randy's group because he shows them the kind of affection and compassion that is, these kids are hungry to see and experience. He has had an incredible impact on our youth. We actually did a radio interview together. His organization is donating somewhere in the neighborhood of $160,000 to rebuild the gym at McLaren, and it's unheard of. You know, generally, a state is looked at as having deep pockets. and outside organizations don't donate money, but Randy understands the importance of sports for youth. He participates in soccer matches, basketball matches, and just last year, one of our youth who had his parents killed in a car accident, he did a service on the soccer field for him, and it was very meaningful to him. So Randy is doing, he's an incredible individual and is adding so much value. There's no way, no words can express my degree of gratitude for the work that he's doing.
Well, just a small follow-up. Thank you for saying that. And it's not, yes, he's doing incredible work. Our church has taken the boys at Hillcrest and McLaren as our agenda. Our agenda is that boys don't ever have to go back there again and that they don't end up in your place. And it's something that we've taken to heart. And I want people to understand that church and state can work together very well. You have a church that's willing to give hundreds of thousands of dollars to a state agency with no strings attached. We're going to build a gym. We provide tennis shoes if needed, mm-hmm. basketball shoes, food, whatever it is. And yet we are at the same time asking the budget committees, oh, why he needs more money. So mm-hmm. it's both and, not either or. And yeah, it's been so exciting to be a part of the program. To watch it from a, kind of a distance, but being a part of it. And yeah, we want to thank you for allowing that to happen.
And thank you, Representative Post. Just one additional piece. One of the major failure points for our youth is transition back to the community.
Yes.
And that is a piece that we are working with Randy, especially with kids who have serious offenses. It's a very difficult path, especially for kids who are charged as adults back to the community. And Randy's already met with our parole and probation supervisor in Marion County, and we're already talking about how that transition can occur effectively with the support from him and his congregation. So thank you.
Well, I can tell you this, the plan that we're putting together here could solve affordable housing in Oregon. Mm-hmm. So. It's a pretty cool program.
Representative Williamson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Fairbairns and Joe, you run a fantastic agency. Your whole team has done really transformational work in the time that I've been involved in this, which hasn't been all that long, really. My question goes to where we're going with girls. You know that I'm particularly concerned about girls in our system, and Director Peters, I will probably ask a similar question with the women in our system. When you look at the numbers, these are girls and women who have been abused, have been trafficked, have healthcare issues, mental health issues, and this is where they're landing. And I'm particularly interested in where we are with the youth reformation system, with the 10-year plan, where are we at with our girls, and what are we doing to better address the needs, the underlying needs of these girls and women, and not letting them get to the place where it's a manifestation of the abuse that they've suffered, mm-hmm. that they end up in the system?
Yeah. Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, I know your passion for girls, and we've talked about that before. And let me be very transparent about this. About 4 years ago, our own parole and probation officers were hesitant in committing youth to Oak Creek Correctional Facility. Today, that culture has changed, and I don't have the data with me. We'll present it at Ways and Means. When you look at the number of incidents in that facility, when you look at the number of hotline complaints, when you look at the number of isolation incidents, it is a downward curve, and a significantly steep downward curve. Mm-hmm. In all of our other facilities, we have deployed what we call skill development coordinators. These are staff who actually work with other staff to show how we can reduce the use of isolation. We have not done that at Oak Creek because we don't need to. We had 7 girls that came back and walked in their high school graduation last year. How many kids go back to where they were locked up? You know, to walk in there, that really has created a family environment. Having said that, and also we have created vocational opportunities as well as educational opportunities for girls. And we built, we actually transferred a greenhouse from Florence to Albany. Kids are actually, we now have a partnership with Lynn Benton Community College, where they're taking welding classes. Having said that, the opportunities for girls are fewer than they are for boys, just because there are fewer of them in the system. I can tell you that the opening, the pilot opening on the Young Women Transition Program is a major step toward helping these girls. And I was talking to the superintendent of that facility, Mike Regan, who you may know, and we were talking about one additional step that's required. And that step is going from our own transition program back to the community. It is very difficult if you have been in an environment where you've been supervised 24 hours a day to go to a place where you're now on your own. In fact, one of the girls who transitioned and was doing an incredible job on a success path fell into some trouble. And when I talked with her, she told me, I sat in my apartment, which ended up being low-income housing and not exactly, you know, the best environment for an 18-year-old, is she said, I stared at the wall, not exactly knowing what to do, because for the past 5 years, I was told what to do every single moment. So we have some challenges, but we are working on them, and we welcome any opportunities that we can get, any ideas that you might have. Trauma is a major, major issue for girls. Getting them to a place of healthy living and really having them find their own path. We're trying to do that through art, through poetry, through photography and some other things, but it's a tough, tough task.
Well, thank you for the work that you're doing.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much for your presentation. Close the informational meeting on the Oregon Youth Authority and open an overview of the Oregon Department of Corrections. Ms. Peters.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, I am Colette Peters. I'm director of the Department of Corrections, and I'm very happy to be here with you this afternoon. On Monday, I celebrated my fifth year as director of the Department of Corrections, and our team has accomplished so much during that time. So I would love the opportunity to spend the whole afternoon talking to you about what we have at the department and what we plan to do, but I don't think time will allow me to do that. So, Mr. Chair, as a point of order, how much time do I have for my presentation?
I have a couple bills, and some people need to leave early, but we'll let you can.
And are you done at 2:30 or 3?
Yeah, go ahead and just go. And okay. I don't want to cut you short.
All right.
It's important. You have an important.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I will start, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, with our mission. The mission is our base. It's our foundation. It's what we build all of our programming and treatment on. The mission is to promote public safety by holding offenders accountable for their actions and reducing their risk of future criminal behavior. Our mission is something that everyone inside our organization focuses on. If you're in the prison, in the community, doing our backbone services in the organization, that mission is something we all feel connected to. And that first part of that mission is something that we have refined over the years. Yet for me, holding offenders accountable isn't just removing them from society for a period of time and carrying out the court's orders. It has to be more than that. It has to be about that reformation, that change, that personal accountability. And that second half of our mission is to reduce the likelihood that individuals will commit another crime after release. Now, what that means for me is another victim is not created. And as a former victim's advocate, that piece is never lost on me. Our business model is technical difficulty. Thank you. Our business model is the Oregon Accountability Model. It keeps us focused to a path of success from day one in prison to the day through release. So what you'll see inside our business strategy is that we use data to determine risk in order to appropriately case plan. We foster a culture of accountability and respect. We do not hire guards at the Department of Corrections. We hire correctional officers who are professionals that are to role model pro-social behavior, redirect negative behavior, and reinforce positive behavior in a fair and humane way. We focus on evidence-based practices. We focus on children and families and transition. And we focus on appropriate treatment, sanctions, and that community support upon reentry. So while our business philosophy remains the same since the last time that we met, we have added another system that complements this philosophy. Having technical difficulties on both ends. We will, and I will talk about that more in a minute. We are responsible for the care and custody of more than 14,600 adults. 1,290 of them are women, incarcerated within 14 prisons across our good state, and these are individuals who have been convicted of felonies and sentenced to more than 1 year in custody. Just to share some offender demographics, 92% of those in our care and custody are men, 41% are between the ages of 31 and 45. Like the Oregon Youth Authority, we have a disproportionate number of minorities in our system. 9% are African American. The general population of Oregon is about 2 to 3%. Inside our prison walls, about 12% of our population are Hispanic. In the general population, it is 8. When you look at the crimes, 68% are in on-person crimes. 82%, just like OYA, 82% have some mental health need. 70% have some substance abuse issue. There are a lot of individuals coming in and out of the Oregon Department of Corrections. We release.
Can I get a repeat of that number, the substance abuse number?
Substance abuse was 70% representative.
70.
Correct.
I thought I heard 7. That woke me up.
Thank you, Representative Greenlick.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. I'm glad to keep you awake.
Not easy with the lights.
No, that's a challenge.
I know. I'm always afraid when those lights dim. So we have a lot of individuals coming in and out of our prisons. We release almost 400 every month. 70%. And we are very proud of our state-run community corrections teams in Douglas and Linn County. So I would like to highlight one area that they focused on this last year, which was increasing the amount of victim restitution collected. And our officers in Linn and Douglas County increased that number by 17%. And this was a success through our performance-based management system, which I will speak to further in just a few minutes. In addition to the direct oversight of Douglas and Linn, we also have indirect oversight of more than 31,000 adults on felony probation, parole, and post-prison supervision in a strong, positive collaboration with the remaining 34 counties. We also have a strong relationship with our two labor organizations, both AOCE and AFSCME. And overall, we have a $1.8 billion budget to carry out our agency's functions. And it is not lost on me that that dollar amount is almost exactly the budget deficit that you are faced with right now. Thank you, Representative Greenlick. That was not lost on me either.
That's not your proposed solution.
For the record, Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlick, that is not what I was proposing. Thank you. Correctional outcomes through research and engagement is what we're calling our performance-based management system. We affectionately refer to it as CORE, as the acronym, and it's allowing us to become a more transparent and outcome-based agency. Just as important, I hope that this performance-based management system really empowers all of our team members to step forward when things aren't working or when they see successes. So CORE began with a very full review of our agency operations as part of our ongoing strategic planning. We mapped nearly every function inside this organization and established a goal and measured a target. This led to our fundamentals map, which we have provided as a handout. The map details those CORE responsibilities and assigns a member of our executive team to manage those outcomes. Next, we developed a set of CORE values, And then we created an agency-wide scorecard. And you can see an example of this here. And that was to track the process measures on our fundamentals map. Now, this is just an example because our overall scorecard is pages and pages. We have 108 measures. And as an executive team, I personally, with my executive team, sit down and we go through every item line by line every quarter. I'm highlighting a few because I want you to know a couple of examples. I think it's important to know that we look at the number of adults in custody who are completing their GED. We are measuring staff wellness. We measure training and the number of grievances we receive, both from our staff and from those in our care and custody. So the scorecard really keeps us in tune with our daily operations. How are we doing? Where are things working? Where are things broken? Where can we become more efficient? So this is really who we are on a day-to-day basis. But what are our issues and where do we want to take the agency? That's what our strategic plan is all about. That's what we're calling Destination 2026. Where do we want to be in 10 years? We hope that this plan will really solidify our organizational identity and culture for years to come. Ultimately, we want the Department of Corrections to be the public safety employer of choice with innovative employees who come to work every day knowing that they can transform lives, the lives of those in our care and custody, and the lives of each other. And I'll talk about staff wellness more later. We are going to hold ourselves accountable to this 10-year plan by looking at 1- and 2-year goals, 4-year goals, and then hopefully arriving successfully in 10 years. Both CORE and the strategic plan broadens the level of decision making in the agency, so we're pushing all of those decisions down in hopes that people are feeling more empowered inside this organization. The plan has what we're referring to as 5 roads, 5 columns that lead us to 2026, and I'll go through those each individually. The first is people and skills. We recognize that we have some of the hardest working public safety professionals in the business. These jobs are stressful, they're demanding, and they're taxing. And we have difficulty recruiting and retaining and promoting our team members. So this road is all about instilling pride in our staff, helping people and the community understand how much we value corrections professionals.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry to interrupt. One thing, the budget, $1.8 billion, is that biannual?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gorsuch, that is biannual.
Biannual. Okay. Second follow-up?
Please.
Okay. How far down are you in terms of your current authorized strength for corrections officers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gorsuch, can you repeat that question?
What would you need to have your organization operate fully staffed compared to where you are now?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Gorsuch, we have engaged in a couple of analyses that I know that you've seen, both in terms of how do we eliminate overtime
right.
and with additional staff, but furthermore, how do we have the number of warm bodies in the right posts at the same time? So we were fortunate that the legislature approved 33 positions in last biennial's budget. The ask was actually 67 more than that, and I will tell you that number is still far less than either of our labor organizations would be asking for. So absolutely that component adds to stress and wear and tear as it relates to not having backup there immediately and also the overtime issue.
So 67 below what you got last time.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Gorsuch, more. That is okay. Correct.
Thank
yes,
you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, please.
Thank you. So this notion of being able to retain and promote individuals, we really want to create a system where we're providing world-class training. During the Great Recession, we cut everything as it relates to training except what was statutorily or legally required. And we really want to hire individuals who are the best and the brightest with a passion for corrections. We really want to find those people that want to come in and really help these people in our care and custody. Now, I know that every state agency is faced with potential massive retirements coming up. That is compounded at the Department of Corrections because 20 to 25 years ago, we built a whole host of prisons, hired those staff, and they stayed on. So now 52% of my staff are eligible to retire in the next 3 years, and I am confident they are watching all of your PERS hearings very closely. So this breakthrough team that has been working on this part of the issue has already realized some successes to date. They have a better understanding of data in regards to retention and retirement rates, why staff actually leave security for non-security positions, and why DOC staff leave the agency. We weren't able to answer that question 2 years ago. We've also developed a recruitment strategy, a new recruitment team at the Department of Corrections, not new bodies, just reassigned individuals, which includes social media, special recruitment for health services, security, and general recruiters. We're also piloting a staff mentoring program at our Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution in Pendleton, which had the highest turnover rate of all of our DOC institutions, upward to 11%. And we're hosting one-day recruitment events at four institutions where you actually come in and we help you fill out the NeoGov application and spend time walking you through the institution. And that has improved results already. We know we can't get to 2026 and our lofty plan without our people. They are our everything. And so staff wellness is our top initiative. This is an issue I'm very passionate about because it is personal. I was drawn to this field because I believe people can change. I wanted to be in a helping field. I believe in humanity. And so I've worked with juveniles, I've worked with victims, and it took me 25 years to figure out that we were overlooking the professionals doing the helping. And it really hit me over the head 5 years ago when I became director, because the agency had had, in an 18-month period, 4 staff suicides. And we looked at the research, and there wasn't any. We had researched police officers, firefighters, even those in the military, and there wasn't anything out there about correctional officers. And the data was so disturbing. 1 in 3 of my officers have symptoms of PTSD. Their cholesterol is through the roof. Their triglycerides are through the roof. They are overweight, they have hypertension and pre-hypertension, and as we looked at the issue, it really is this notion that they are in this constant state of hypervigilance. Now, this was an issue that wasn't addressed nationally either. When I shared this information with my peers across the country, they said, we've attended the funerals, we've held the hands through the divorces, we've watched the decertifications through the DUIs, but we've never studied it. So we have now, and the agency has well over 100 wellness plans, programs across the state, and we have a strategic initiative working on figuring out exactly what we can do to solve this problem locally. OHSU and PSU were the ones that came in to study the issue, and I'm pleased to let you know that because of the work in Oregon, the nation is actually paying attention to it. The American Correctional Association has adopted a wellness resolution. They're our largest association in the country. The American Correctional Association Healthy Culture Committee, of which I chair, is developing a wellness policy. The National Institute of Corrections has made this a top priority, and the Association of State Correctional Administrators has also just created wellness as one of their top initiatives. So we hope to get help from around the country in solving this problem. Culture. Every organization needs to keep its pulse on culture. Even more important when that organization is charged with the behavior change of violent and serious offenders. We know we don't have a perfect culture, but we strive to be perfect every day. And when our staff are not well, it's even more difficult to get to Destination 2026. So one of the things that we've latched onto from the Portland State University study is the conclusion that they were able to draw is that the one thing that could change the wellness of our team members was if those team members felt valued, not by the director, but by their frontline manager, and that frontline manager valued their families. And so we're working on messaging and training to help our managers really understand that issue. We are also starting by collecting data about our culture in order to determine even better next steps and more specific next steps. Many of you have often heard me talk about some of the positive outcomes we have experienced in Oregon's public safety communities. We have one of the lowest recidivism rates in the country. Comparatively, our prisons are very safe. We use evidence-based programs in prison and in the community, and we recognize that we need to do better. So this area is all about increasing these positive outcomes. We will be focusing on safe and secure workplaces, assuring that those adults in our custody are placed in right housing situation, modernizing technology, and ultimately, we hope, reducing future victimization even further. Last but not least is reentry and supervision. And I say and not least because we believe at the Department of Corrections that that conversation begins on day one at the Department of Corrections. We have to be focused continually on that reentry back into the community. And in my 25 years in public safety, I have always been a firm believer in accountability, in rehabilitation, and the obligation to help individuals prepare for that successful reentry. That's what we all want. We all that want them to be healthy, taxpaying Oregonians. And what we do in corrections echoes the Oregon Constitution. First and foremost, we protect public safety. Secondly, we hold offenders accountable and require them, as I said in my opening comments, to take that personal responsibility, both for their crimes and for their behaviors inside our institutions. And third, we have to allow for that rehabilitation or reformation through programs and services. So we are focusing on those in our custody meeting the goals of their case plan so they leave DOC with the skills and resources to successfully transition. That's something we're actually counting now. That's part of our scorecard. We've always utilized evidence-based programs, but we're having conversations around the evaluation of those programs and ensuring their fidelity, and that those in custody and those on supervision pay towards their court-ordered financial obligations. In our current state, we don't even have the technology to collect those funds for those victims. So that's a good segue to, now that I've taken you out 10 years to where we want to be, I will bring you back to today, legislation. So while we have 12 pieces of legislation that we've brought forward, and far more, of course, that we will be monitoring, I want to highlight just one of ours and one that the Senate Judiciary Committee is bringing forward on our behalf. And I'll start with that bill as it ties to the restitution conversation I just noted. The Inmate Financial Accountability Work Group was actually chaired by the Department of Corrections and staffed by the Department of Corrections, and it had one goal: to develop a system where the Department of Corrections can collect a portion of monies to go toward court-ordered obligations, such as victim restitution, compensatory fines and fees, and court fines and fees. While this, as I said earlier, isn't a DOC bill, it is something very important to our agency. I think it ties directly back to our mission that I mentioned as in my opening comments. And we are so grateful for the individuals that worked on that work group to come up with a workable solution. The second bill I want to highlight is a concept that I worked on with Director Fairbors Paksuresh from the Oregon Youth Authority. And this would codify our long-standing practice of not housing anyone under the age of 18 in the Department of Corrections. It's currently allowed under statute. It's clearly spelled out in law. It's a practice that we stopped when Director Max Williams was the director of the Department of Corrections and I was the director of OYA. It used to be, and I think Deputy Director O'Leary alluded to it in his comments, we used to send individuals to the Department of Corrections for behavior issues. If you misbehaved, if you weren't engaging in programming, the data analytics were very clear that that is something we should not be doing, and we are actually making them tougher offenders. And so Director Williams and I stopped that practice back in 2009. This codifies that so that it lives beyond any of us directors today. So it also aligns with federal sight and sound regulations and clearly is a best practice across the country. So with that, Mr. Chair, that concludes my presentation, and I'm happy to answer any questions you or the committee might have.
I have just one brief one. So when you heard us talking to the Youth Authority about the people that age out of there and come over, And so they were saying that several of those people are short-term, months or a few months or everything. Where do you send them when they arrive?
Mr. Chair, it depends on the individual. If it's an individual who just has a few months left, has been a well-behaved individual engaging in programming and treatment, the likelihood that they would end up here in Salem at the Oregon State Correctional Institution is very high. If they're having behavior management issues, acting out, harming staff, it would be a different placement.
Okay. So for the most part, they go to minimum until you can age them. Okay, thank you. Representative Sanchez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me a little bit more about this inmate financial accountability piece? Because I just happen to know how much are we talking about? I know that not everybody has jobs. Not everybody has the capacity to do that. I also know that oftentimes our Native American inmates who receive trust monies into their accounts. And so is there a percentage? Is there a plan for that? And what would be happening to folks who, you know, maybe only have a job for a short period of time or move from to another facility and then don't, you know, is their money just going to keep going away? And it's a frustration for me, having done transition with women coming out of the prisons and seeing them come out with a card that has 2 cents on it.
Right. Mr. Chair and Representative Sanchez, first may I say thank you for all the volunteer hours you've put in at Coffee Creek. We could not operate the prisons the way we do without our volunteers, so thank you. Secondarily, I share all of your concerns. And so this Inmate Financial Accountability Work Group actually was born out of last legislative session, where a bill was introduced that would every month take 70% out of their trust account every month. And we were very concerned both about transition and reentry and an inability for them to be successful upon release. I was also concerned about safety and security inside the prisons if we were to make a shift like that. And so that is why I'm so grateful for this work group really coming together with a workable solution. There is a minimum amount, Representative Sanchez, and I wish I had it memorized and I don't, but we'll get it to you. There's a minimum amount that account cannot go below, plus the compromise includes a reentry savings account. So you actually have to build up, I believe it's $500 in your account before any monies can actually be taken out. And then there is a percentage that's taken out after that. And I'm embarrassed I don't have that percentage memorized, but we'll get that to you too. So we tried to address those exact concerns because they were my fear as well. In that vein, if we do it right, these individuals could actually be better off than they are under current practice because of that reentry savings account.
Representative Williamson.
Thank you, Director Peters, for you and your team. You guys do fantastic work in challenging times, so I want to thank you for your leadership, especially your leadership nationally on employee wellness. It is a crisis, and you have moved mountains to start to address that, and so I just want to recognize that. Your team has done a fantastic job.
Thank you.
My question is similar to the one I had for Director Pashkaresht. Tell me about the women in your custody. They're increasing at a faster rate than the men. What do you know about the women in your custody, and what are you seeing, and how are we addressing it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Williamson, it is a great concern. You think about Destination 2026 and our planning in that direction, and Coffee Creek Correctional Facility was supposed to be sufficient until 2026 when we built it. So the prison projections at that time thought that the women would grow at a rate where that prison would be facility space enough until 2026. That is not where we are today. We are sitting on the razor's edge with our population, and we have 122 temporary and emergency beds, which are far more beds than I said I would allow. I think that is stressful on the women in our care and custody. It is certainly stressful on our team members. So what we're finding is exactly what Deputy Director O'Leary talked about. What we couldn't predict back when we built Coffee Creek was the meth epidemic. And the meth epidemic has had a disproportionate impact on women. And so the women that we see, when I mentioned the statistic earlier around the property crimes driving our population, it's disproportionate with the women. And if they are there for property crimes, it's likely because they are supporting their drug addiction. Now, what are we doing inside to address it? So we have engaged in gender-specific programming at Coffee Creek. Again, the volunteers that we have at Coffee Creek allow us to have amazing family events where these children get to come in for an entire day to spend with their families either at a barbecue or a picnic or the TACE event, which I've invited you all to on occasion. So those volunteers have helped us do that. We've also developed what we're affectionately referring to as the WARNA, the Women's Assessment Risk and Needs Tool. That's not right. I just completely boggled that. But it's a risk tool for women specifically, and that's very unique in the country as well. We learned very early on that the risk tool that we use for the men doesn't apply to the women, the risk and needs tool. And so we are implementing that tool now. We hope that that will better align programming and treatment for those women in our care to improve their outcomes. So those are a few things that I can think of now. For those of you that have been to Coffee Creek, I'm sure you've been handed the list of programs that we have at Coffee Creek. We have many more programs at Coffee Creek than we do in our male institutions, and it's because of our volunteers. We have, happily, a disproportionate number of volunteers at that facility. And so we continue to improve, we continue to enhance what we're doing, but it certainly is an issue that we're trying to address.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
We are short on time.
So okay, I'll do it really quick. So we talked before about staffing and the problems with that, and, of course, a lot of that is funding issues. What's been the status of violence within the prisons? Has it been a significant problem because of the lower staff, or how would you typify that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gorsuch, this is where my staff pay for being great because those numbers haven't increased because they are so good at what they do. But it only will take one incident before we look back and say, why did we not provide the staff that the data and the assessments said were necessary? And so those are numbers that we track in our scorecard, both inmate on staff counts, inmate on staff and inmate on inmate counts, so that we can really monitor the level of safety inside of our institutions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much, Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
And we'll quickly open a public hearing on House Bill 2253.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. House Bill 2253 was brought to us at the request of the Department of Corrections. In Oregon, inmates are required to be actively engaged in work or training. Oregon Corrections Enterprises works with DOC to provide inmates with work and training opportunities. House Bill 2253 would allow inmates to perform electrical or plumbing work while under the direct supervision of a licensed electrician or plumber who is an employee of DOC or OCE. It would also allow OCE to supervise inmates participating in a DOC or OCE program. There are no amendments, and there is no revenue or fiscal impact.
Thank you. Please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the House of Judiciary Committee. My name is Ken Jeske. I'm the administrator for Oregon Corrections Enterprises, or OCE. Thank you for letting me be here. As she mentioned, Oregon Corrections Enterprises is a semi-independent state agency that operates the inmate work and training programs at the Department of Corrections, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2253 and answer any of your questions.
Okay, are there any questions?
I have.
Please.
I was trying to make out the main difference in the bill between the situation now and what would be allowed, under this bill. It looked like they can work as electricians and plumbers now. The difference is that they need to be under an employee electrician or plumber. Is that the case, or can they not work under the current situation?
So Chair Barker and Representative Greenlick, currently the OCE cannot supervise inmates that are doing electrical work because of a change to House Bill 3245 in 2013. During that discussion, OCE staff were included as the licensed electrician and plumbers were allowed to supervise the inmates, but for some reason unknown to us, we couldn't find how this happened, but OCE was dropped off of that bill. So this bill would just add OCE's licensed electricians back into that and allow us to supervise that work.
Thank you. Hey, are there any further questions? Okay, thank you very much. Close the public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 2253.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2253 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2253 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Williamson will carry. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2334.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. House Bill 2334 was brought to us at the request of the Oregon Department of Administrative Services. House Bill 2334 creates the Juvenile Corrections Population Forecast Advisory Committee. The committee would be tasked with assisting the Department of Administrative Services in preparing projections of juvenile offender populations. This forecast is intended for use by the Oregon Youth Authority in preparing budget requests, the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission in considering amendments to sentencing guidelines, and for any other state agency concerned with juvenile offender populations or policy developments on budgeting. There is no revenue or fiscal impact, and there are no amendments.
Thank you. Please.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lindsay Baker, and I'm the Director of Government Relations at the Department of Administrative Services. As you all know, since 1998, pursuant to four now executive orders, the Office of Economic Analysis, which resides inside of the DAS Director's office, twice a year in April and October performs the Juvenile Corrections Forecast, Population Forecast. This is done, again, by the Office of Economic Analysis in conjunction and with advice from the Juvenile Corrections Population Forecast Advisory Committee. So, like I said, this has been conducted pursuant to executive orders four times now. My understanding, based on my reading of those executive orders, is that it really hasn't changed substantively much at all. So this bill merely codifies what that existing practice is and sets in statute the existence of the committee, the fact that DAS, the Office of Economic Analysis, is charged with conducting the biannual forecast, and that's all that it does. Okay. I'm happy to answer questions if there are any.
Okay, are there any questions from anybody? Representative Springer, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I read through this bill multiple times, what I noticed is what wasn't there, and maybe this is me being on education committees for so long. It does not address in any way the makeup of the committee. Mm-hmm. Was there conversation about that, whether it be a diversity of representing different parts of the state, different entities? Talk to me a little bit about that. The only thing it does require is have some knowledge of the juvenile justice system. That was the one requirement that I saw. Would you speak to that, please?
Sure. So I will give you my current understanding, which is the work on this particular measure predated my being at the agency. However, I think that it was, again, just an attempt to codify what's an existing practice. So in every single executive order to date, it merely says not more than seven appointed by the governor. So to my knowledge, there has been not a robust conversation in terms of prescribing more specificity with the composition of the committee. However, if that is a discussion the committee would like to have, I know we would be happy to have that discussion.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Appreciate you. Close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2334.
Chair, I move House Bill 2334 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2334 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Anybody like to carry that one? Okay. Representative Springer will be our carrier. Thank you, Representative. We stand adjourned. Thank you, committee.
Guess what?
Committee.
Guess what?
We stand adjourned. Thank you.